Chapter 20. When Draymond returned home from the 22nd Precinct House, wearing damp clothes and soggy shoes, it was late afternoon. He had to order Chun Jin to the kitchen because the man persisted in asking ridiculous questions. They had a brisk exchange of shouts and sulks. Then Raymond showered and took a 2-hour dreamless nap. He awoke thinking about Josie. He decided that she should be clearing customs just about then. He could not think about his letter, whether she had read it or torn it up in distaste. He could not imagine what she felt or would feel. He dressed slowly and began to pack for the weekend. He removed the gaucho costume from its cardboard box and packed it carefully. He felt a flood of panic as he folded it in. Maybe this silly monkey suit would remind Josie of her husband. Why in the name of sweet Jesus had he ordered such a costume? It couldn't possibly resemble anything in real life, he decided. Cattle people didn't wear silk bloomers. They were for Yul Brynner or somebody who was kidding. It was probably the kind of a suit they wore to dances or fiestas a couple of times a year. Surely neither Josie nor her husband would have attended such dances. But what the hell was he being so literal for? You didn't have to see a lot of people walking around in suits like these to know that they were symbolic of the Argentine. What would she think? Would she think he was being cruel or unkind or rude or insensitive? He fussed and pottered and grumbled to himself, conjecturing about the reactions of a woman he hadn't seen since she had been a girl, but did not give a thought to having jumped out of a rowboat into a shallow lake in broad daylight in the center of a city, because it embarrassed him to have to think of himself as having so lacked grace in front of all those strangers and those goddamn policemen who had treated him as if he was Bellevue Hospital's problem and not theirs. He also would not think of it because he could not afford to get angry with Joe Downey, his boss, who could have at least had the consideration to keep the story out of all the newspapers, and if not all the newspapers, surely out of his own front page. He snapped the suitcase shut. He carried it to the bedroom door, worrying about what the hell Josie would think of him when she saw those idiot newspapers at the airport. He flung open the door, then began a tug of war over the suitcase with Chun Jin as he dragged both of them toward the square tiled foyer. For Christ's sake, Chun Jin! It made him even angrier for having spoken to this pushy little type at all, and a loud discussion started. Chun Jin did not want him to take the Long Island Railroad to his mother's house. Opposing it bitterly, he maintained that it was not sound for a rich man to wrestle with a large bag in a crowded railroad car. Raymond said he certainly was not going to put up with this kind of insubordination, and if it continued for just about 2 more sentences, Chun Jin could go in and pack his own cardboard suitcase and get the hell out for good. He felt foolish as soon as he had said it, because he remembered suddenly that Chun Jin did not sleep in, and of course had no suitcase on the premises. Chun Jin said loudly that he had taken the liberty of renting an automobile and the correct dark uniform of a proper chauffeur, the jacket of which Mr. Shaw could look upon as he was even now wearing it. Chun Jin said he would drive Mr. Shaw to his mother's house in comfort, and at a level with Mr. Shaw's dignity and position in the world. To Raymond, all of this was an utterly new conception, perhaps as television would have been to the inventor of the wheel. Raymond had loved automobiles all his life, although he could not drive one, but he had never thought of renting one. He was transformed, enchanted.
You rented a car?
Yes, sir, Mr. Shaw.
What kind?
Cadillac.
Well.
Marvelous.
What color?
West Point gray, French blue seats, leather, genuine, rear seat radio.
Wonderful.
Tax deductible also.
Is that so?
How? You will read the booklet in the car, Mr. Shaw.
Chun Jin put on his dark chauffeur's cap. He took the suitcase away from Raymond without a struggle.
We go now, Mr. Shaw? 7 o'clock. 2 hours to drive.
I don't know this house, you know. It's a rented house. I don't know about a place for you to stay.
My job find place. You not think, ride and read reports from newspaper. Think about condition of world.
Dressed as a costumer's conception of a gaucho, Raymond came down his mother's rented winding stairs, railed in English copper, stainless steel, and lucite, and into an entrance hall that might have been hewn by a cast of Grimm Brothers gnomes out of a marble mountain. It was studded with bronze zodiacal designs and purred with concealed neon light in an arrangement that pulled Raymond toward the great drawing room, on the threshold of which Senator and Mrs. Iselin were receiving their guests. The older guests who shook hands with the Iselins that night had been followers of Father Coughlin, The group just younger than them had rallied around Gerald L.K. Smith, and the rest, still younger, were fringe lice who saw Johnny's significance in a clear white light. The Klan had turned out from 10,000 yesterdays in the Middle West and Neolithic Texas, and patriotism was far from being their last refuge. It was a group for anthropologists, and it seemed like very bad manners, or very bad judgment on Raymond's mother's part, to have invited Senator Jordan to walk among the likes of these. Johnny and Ellie, as Raymond's mother was called by most of the guests, were costumed as honest dairy farm folk would look if honest dairy farmers had had their work clothes built by Balenciaga. Raymond's mother had figured that the press photographs of these costumes would be viewed with great favor in the Iceland home state, where building foundations were made of butter. Voters would be told that Big John never forgot where he came from. As she embraced Raymond in their mutually distasteful greeting, she whispered that Josie's plane had run late out of San Juan, but that she was now in the house next door, and she had telephoned to say that she would be over no later than midnight, and had asked, anxiously, if Raymond would be there. He felt for an instant that he might faint. Anxiously? Why anxiously? Did she sound as though she were fearful that I might be here?
Oh, don't be such a jerk, Raymond. If you weren't here, do you think for a moment that the Jordans would come here?
Don't call me a jerk, Mother.
Go have a drink or a tranquilizer or something.
She turned to her husband.
Raymond can certainly be a pain in the ass, she said with asperity.
She's kidding you, Johnny said. You sure look great, kid. What are you supposed to be, one of those Dutch skaters?
What else? Raymond answered. He walked through the crowds, acknowledging greetings, forbiddingly, and feeling his heart beating as though it were trying to splinter a way out through his ribs. He walked among, but shunned contact with, the crowds on the broad lawns behind the house, all of which, excepting one section, were brilliantly illuminated with non-communist Japanese lanterns and filled with striped tents. The dark section pulled Raymond to it. It faced the Jordan house. It was a walled-off piece of ground, as isolated as a private deck on an ocean liner. He stood there beside the wall, staring across at the Jordan house, without the reward of being able to observe any movement there. Frustrated, and more than usually resentful, he wandered back to the Iceland house through crowds of stout blonde Carmens and Kansas Borgias, unhorsed Godivas, unfrocked Richelieus, and many businessmen dressed as pirates. Many of the costumes were quaint American Legion uniforms, so like those of the squadristi of former days in Italy, encasing various sizes of fleshy prejudice which exchanged opinions they rented that week from Mr. Sokolsky, Mr. Lawrence, Mr. Pegler, and that fascinating younger fellow who had written about men and God at Yale. The three orchestras tried to avoid playing at the same time. The Iselands had provided very nearly everything but balalaikas in the way of music. There was a society orchestra, a three-cha combo, and an inundation of gallant white Russian fiddlers who migrated across the grounds and, in and out of the house en masse, sawing like locusts. And not only did they accept tips, but they very nearly frisked the guests to get them. Raymond stopped at one of the four bars and drank a half glass of champagne. He refused offers to dance with three young women of different sizes. His mother found him later, far in a corner of the large salon, behind a pastel sofa, under two threats of Salvador Dali, a Catalan.
"My God, you look as though your head will come to a point any minute," she told him. "Raymond, will you please take a tranquilizer?"
"No."
"Why?"
"I have a revulsion for drugs."
"You look absolutely miserable." "Never mind. A half hour more and she'll be here." "My feet hurt." "Why don't we just sneak away for a few minutes until Josie and her father arrive? We can sit in the library and sip cold wine."
Raymond looked right at her, and for the first time in many, many years, actually smiled at her, and she thought he looked positively beautiful. Why, he looks like Papa. Raymond, her own Raymond, looked exactly like her darling, darling Papa. She clutched his hand as she led him out of the salon and along the two corridors to the library, causing one woman guest to tell another woman guest that they looked as though they were rushing off to get a little of you-know-what, Mrs. Iseland trailing a delicious scent of Jolie Madame, because she had read that Lola Brigida wore it, and she had always wished she could be short like that, and stopping only to get a bottle of wine and to tell the butler where they would be. The library was a small, pleasant room, and the books were real. The fourth wall was transparent glass, and faced that walled deck of land and Josie's house. Raymond stood rubbing his hands together, so very tall and so preposterously handsome in the short shining boots, the ballooning trousers, and the wide expanse of white silk shirt. "Do you know they got in from the airport?" he asked, as he poured the lemon-yellow wine into two sherbet glasses.
"I told you," his mother said. "She telephoned me. From that house."
"How did she sound?"
"Like a girl."
"Thanks." She leaned forward tensely in the raspberry-colored chair, splendid in pink chiffon.
"Raymond?"
"What?" He handed her one of the filled glasses. She took it with her bandaged left hand. "What did you do to your hand?" he asked, seeing the bandage for the first time.
"I got careless in Washington this afternoon and got it caught in the door of a taxi."
He grunted involuntarily.
"Raymond," she said, transferring the wine to her right hand and lifting it shakily. "Why don't you pass the time by playing a little solitaire?"